of it. I thought I just needed a short break. Just like you, only it took me 3 years to come back, not 2 months.
The two things are nothing alike, I snap, though of course I have compared us in my mind time and time again. John shakes his head.
No, they're not. You're a better parent than me. A better person. In fact, as far as I can tell, all you want to be in the world is the person opposite of me.
I can see he is wounded, but he doesn't stop talking.
You see the sadness of that, right, Amy? Not only have you not moved on in 3 entire years, you've defined yourself solely and completely as the woman I martyred.
The woman he martyred. The words make me furious. The words are true. Why did you come back here, John? I ask. I should have asked him that months ago. I should have pushed him harder, made him explain himself, stopped tiptoeing around, terrified of, what did I call it? Upsetting the apple cart? The hell with the goddamned apple cart. Did you come back for me? He lets out a long breath.
I came back for them, Joe and Corey. And I do love you, Amy. After 18 years of marriage, I think I'll always love you.
He drops the wheel with his right hand and reaches over to give my arm a familiar squeeze.
I thought maybe when I was back, I'd find the best thing for the kids would be to try to recover our marriage. And the idea hardly felt like a chore. You're as beautiful as ever, and an amazing mother. And you've been more patient with this process than anyone else would have been in your place.
I shake my head. It may have been what I wanted to hear at the beginning of the summer. Now it sinks like a stone. I don't want that, John. He nods, and I think I see just a trace of regret in his eyes.
I know that now. And I don't think the kids need it either.
He's right. I breathe in, try hard to breathe out. So then, what? I ask him. What is your plan? He hesitates for a second.
I think when the summer's over, it'll be time for me to head back overseas. I'll miss the kids terribly, but I've got to get back into the office eventually. And there's no question you guys will be totally fine after I'm gone.
His words hit me like tumbling bricks. I wanted the truth. I thought I was ready for the truth. But now that I have it, I feel beaten. Not just beaten, completely taken apart. Nothing has changed. I have left behind Daniel and Talia and New York and everything I felt I could be there to come back to the exact same way things were before John walked back into all of our lives. Only worse, because now Joe, Corey, and I will know firsthand exactly what we were all missing. For a while after that, John and I drive in silence. A city of pain built inside my heart throbs mournfully. The buildings constructed of regret and loss, the streets paved in fear. In my mind, I walk through it, wade through the hurt of what he just said, the monuments to heartbreak I have built inside me, traveling back through time. The day I left Daniel in New York. The day I saw John at the drugstore. The day I found out about Marika. The day John called from Hong Kong, saying he was never coming back. The day I went in for my 13-week appointment, and there was no more heartbeat. It is at this last monument, a secret known only to John and me, where I can go no further. They asked me at the time, did I want to run DNA tests on the fetus? Did I experience any cramping or bleeding? Did I want to know the gender? Were we planning to try for subsequent pregnancies? But I was so stunned, it was all noise. I had never miscarried before. I'd had no reason to think I would now. I was taking folate, hadn't had a drink since week 4, was appropriately sick, tender breasts, 8 pounds of new weight. I rattled these statistics off to the doctor to try to convince her that she was wrong. I told her, as if it mattered, as if she didn't know, that I had been pregnant for almost 3 months. I had already started the baby's 529 plan.
Your phone is ringing,
says John, back in the car, back in the present, back in the place where the baby wasn't born and the husband didn't stay and I spent the last 5 years holding on to those hurts like my life depended on it. What? I ask.
Your phone. That buzzing sound. It sounds like a phone set on vibrate.
Oh, yes, you're right. It's my phone.
Aren't you going to answer it?
I don't make any move to do so. It could be Daniel, or Talia, home from Miami and wondering where I've gone, or Matt, upset that I've bailed without a word, or any number of other people I've let down. Then it stops ringing and starts again. I get the phone out in time to see the voicemail pop up, an area code I don't recognize. The message transcribes slowly, slowly, and at last I read it. Then I drop the phone, stunned. John, turn the car around. Turn it around now. Corey's been hurt.
What?
There, use that turnaround there. Go back to the college.
What happened?
He demands, but he is signaling left, slowing down at a sheriff's throughway. We have to go to the hospital, I tell him, and there is new terror in my voice. It's Corey. I grab him by the shoulder. She hit her head on the diving board, and she hasn't woken up. Chapter 18. When Corey was newly 3 years old, we told her the big news. Brace yourself for a brother or a sister, we said. This is going to be exciting, but disruptive, too. At the time, Corey was speech delayed. We tried not to overreact, but we were first-time parents, and everything slightly out of the ordinary could be a portent of something dire. So I wasted hours of my life fretting and reading up on delays and harassing the poor kid with tongue exercises. Corey, the rebel that she was, responded by talking even less and pointing at things and saying, that, instead of using what nouns she actually had in her wheelhouse. The speech therapist told us to pretend not to know what she was indicating. By understanding her every whim without words, they told me, I was creating in Corey learned helplessness. Maybe so, I thought. Maybe this was all my fault, as the mother. Or maybe she just didn't feel like talking yet, and we could all get off my back. But I was cowed into following the experts' rules. So when Corey pointed at my womb region and said, that, I said, hmm? And she said, baby? And I said, yes, there's a baby in there. And she said, Corey don't want that baby. And I told myself, well, it's a nice long sentence, so that's something. But I was scared. With Joe, John and I hadn't been going crazy trying to get pregnant, but it had taken longer than we'd expected for it to happen, and we'd gotten to that point right before you go to the doctor to see if something's wrong. We actually had the appointments made. John wanted me to go first. Then if I checked out, he'd go. He justified this by telling me that eggs get dusty fast, and let me tell you, this kind of talk did not make me excited about the work that goes into conception. Sex was getting bad, and I was feeling resentful, and foreplay had transformed into comments like, let's get it over with, and it's go time, like it or not. Then, thank goodness, I missed my period. I took a home test, and it was positive, and we waited 3 months, and then we told Corey, and she told us she didn't want that baby. Things had been strained between me and John. And I looked him in the face and wondered if I was the only one who wanted that baby in the whole house. It felt lonely. But of course, half a year later, Joe was born, we all fell in love, and Corey in particular felt that Joe belonged to her. They were far apart in age, but they still were good at entertaining each other. Corey did not help with diapers willingly, but she loved feeding Joe, and in fact did some midnight bottles when John traveled for work. And Joe was drinking more milk than I could make myself. Half asleep, I'd hear Joe start to stir in the bassinet next to me, but before I could even think what to do next, Corey would be awake in her room and then down in the kitchen in her learning tower, washing her hands carefully, hollering at me to come check the temperature of the bottle. Then she'd feed him while I half-dozed, and while he ate, she'd chat to him using words she'd never used with me or John.
"Okay, baby," she'd say. "Time to gobble up some milk. Yummy milk. Formula. We need to be nice and quiet so mommy can sleep. Do you have to fart?"
After the bottle was gone, Corey would set it on the nightstand, crawl over my body, and go right back to sleep on the other side of me, like this was her natural place all along. In his attached bassinet, Joe would fuss a bit. I just reached a semi-conscious arm over to him and coaxed gas out, did that weird thing moms do, where they check for poopy diapers by sticking their fingers right into where the poop might be, took care of any business, went back to sleep. We did this strange dance as a team, a little mother-daughter pas de deux, whenever John was gone for work, and he was gone most weekdays. We were a finely tuned parenting machine, my four-year-old and I. But John, grown man though he was not like Corey. He came back for the weekends too tired to do late-night bottles, and he shooed Corey back to bed whenever she got up in the night to help. During the days on weekends, John would take Corey for amazing adventures, park days and picnics and baseball games and swimming. Joe and I would sleep in, and I would tell myself how lucky I was for these much-needed breaks. But I missed Corey on those days, and I never missed John on the others. That, the weird, involuntary shifting of affection from my husband to my children, was not uncommon, I knew. I also knew it was a phase. Women with older kids told me about romantic renaissances they enjoyed when the children were old enough for sleepovers and trips alone to grandma's. I tried not to beat myself up for avoiding sex in those early years, or substituting early bedtimes for date nights, or wearing quite so many holy stretched-out sweatpants quite so many days in a row. But when he left, did a secret, ashamed part of me believe it had been all my fault? And maybe, was it myself I was actually so mad at all this time? As we speed toward the hospital, I think of all this. I think of Corey hurt, and every time she fell off her bike, or slipped from a swing, or tumbled off a ladder she should never have been on in the first place. I think with amazing clarity, who cares who did what or why? This man and I combined our genetics to make something greater than the sum of its parts. We made two children I love more than I have ever loved anything else, and now one of them is hurt, and it doesn't matter why, and it's no one's fault, not John's, not even my own. All that matters now is that we get there, and she wakes up, and when she does, she finds both her mother and father by her side. There's a big, beautiful hospital near campus. There are pretty bronze statues in the courtyard, and valets wait to grab our keys as we fly into the drive. Everything is clean and shining. The elevators have pictures to remind you of what floor you're on. I ignore all of this and abandon the car and John in it and run into the emergency room. Corey has already been moved. I get into another line and shout, "Corey Byler!" And the LPN says, "TBI? Fourth floor." TBI. This is something that diving mothers never, ever talk about. We talk about concussions constantly. What to do, how to recognize one, where to go, what questions to ask. But the phrase traumatic brain injury is one we are careful not to utter. Concussions mean rest, benching, weeks off from school, athletic setback. TBI means brain damage. I burst into the fourth floor waiting room like I am personally charged with saving Corey from a painful death. "Where is she?" I holler. "Corinne Byler, UP health member number 320378, date of birth 9/27. Slow down, says a man at the front desk. "Are you the patient's mother?" I nod. "We've been waiting for you. I can take you back to her respite area. Page a doctor. Do you have any ID? I nearly grab the poor guy by his lapels. "Yes," I say. "Take me back." I throw my license at him, and he makes me a wristband. The elevator doors open behind me, and I dimly register John getting off. I took the stairs two at a time, and I am panting. His mouth is set in a hard line. I gesture at him, telling the CNA, "That's her dad, too. Let him in. John, show him your driver's license."
"Hang on, sir. I'll be right back for you. Ma'am, follow me," he says to me.
He uses a key tag to get me through a set of locked doors and down a corridor of treatment rooms. He drops me off with a nurse and says,
"Mother of Corey Byler, room 428,
and then turns right back the way he came. The nurse takes me by the arm and starts to walk down another hall.
"Your daughter seems to have sustained a head injury from a diving board. We are watching for mild to moderate traumatic brain injury. There is some imaging we need to do, and right now she is semi-conscious, ranking pretty high on a GCS.
I don't know what this means, but I am too discombobulated to ask for clarification.
"I will get a doctor in to talk to you as soon as possible," he continues. "You can see her soon, but she is, as I said, pretty disoriented. Think of someone who is only half awake."
I think of myself in the bed with Corey and Joe as babies, half awake, listening to my speech-delayed daughter hold forth. I was still very aware of what was around me. I'm going in there now.
"This is the ICU Family Respite Center. There's coffee and juice and... ma'am?"
I see Corey's date of birth written on a whiteboard on the very next door, room 428, followed by the letters TBI. Not that tricky to discern where she is. I open the door carefully and peek inside. It's Corey, asleep. I bust on in.
"Okay, ma'am," says the RN sternly, following me. "You need to go to the family respite center." "Ma'am, you're going to upset yourself."
Corey is in bed with an oxygen mask and an IV stand with three bags hanging from it. The room sounds like a soap opera set. Bleep, bleep,
whoosh, whoosh.
Corey's mouth is open, and she's drooling out of the mask. Drool means alive. I start to cry.
"It's upsetting, ma'am. That's why I told you not to."
"I'm not upset," I tell him. "Look at her. She's breathing." Corey turns her head toward me. Her eyes flutter open, and then closed. She can hear me. I choke some more tears down and take her by the hand and say with false cheer, "Well, there you are, drooling like a golden retriever. You had me scared, girl. You're supposed to bounce on the board with your feet, not your skull." Corey's eyes open, and there's a twinkle in them, and then they close again. I turn away. "Are you on top of pain management?" I ask the RN sharply.
"I am quite sure we are, ma'am, but now you need to go back to the respite area. Have a cup of chamomile tea. A doctor will be in to talk to you shortly."
This time I do as he says. I go in the waiting area. I am the only one there. The TV is on to C-SPAN. The room smells of gas station coffee. The chairs are standard issue hospital waiting room. I sit down on one and let myself cry a little. After a short time, John moves into the room and sits on the chair next to mine. I pick one of the double-wide ones, thinking I may be here for a while, and am thankful John has the good sense not to try to sit in it with me. This way, there is a pleasant gulf between us. I set my elbows on my knees, rest my face in my hands, and go back to my crying. John reaches over and rubs my back absentmindedly.
"Did you see a doctor yet?"
I shake my head. "Not yet, but I saw Corey. She is definitely alive." John makes a little choking sound.
"Well, Christ, Amy, is that all we were hoping for?"
"It's a good start," I say. "They say she has traumatic brain injury. They're looking at pictures of her brain to see if there's been permanent damage." I let my voice trail off. "Is that what you want me to say?" John is quiet. "You know, I suddenly feel the need to lecture him. The kids got sick while you were gone. They got hurt. They did stupid things and had fights and got sick and needed to be rushed to urgent care and the ER and cost cutters."
"Cost cutters?"
"Lice," I say. I tried to give Joe a buzz cut to get them out, but I did a hatchet job and we had to go in to figure something out so he could be seen in public again.
What are you talking about? What does this have to do with lice?
John asks. The point is, I have had emergencies with these children of ours. Lots of them. And after you ascertain that everyone is alive and no one is on fire, you go ahead from there.
Okay. Good tip.
He sounds angry. And what right does he have to be angry with me? But of course, I'm angry with him too, and the nurse, and anyone else unlucky enough to confirm this isn't some nasty dream. This may be your first real kid crisis, but it's not mine.
This is more than a kid crisis,
John says.
She's not fully conscious. There could be swelling or bleeding or brain damage.
I look up at the ceiling. Doesn't he know you should never say your worst parenting fears aloud? You've been watching reruns of ER? Be cool. Don't jinx her.
Jinx her? What is wrong with you?
He asks.
This isn't a T-ball game.
Hush, I say. The doctor, or at least someone in a long white coat, is coming. She walks in, stands in front of us, and says,
My name is Dr. Bach. Are you the parents of Corinne Beiler?
John says nothing. I nod, show my wristband, and say, What do you know?
We've had a good look at the CT scan, and unfortunately there is bleeding, a subarachnoid hemorrhage that I believe we can operate on successfully. It would have been post-traumatic. As I understand it, she hit her head while diving yesterday, so she maybe went home feeling okay, got a bad headache, symptomatic of the SAH, went to bed and then couldn't wake up. Is that how you heard it, too?
I nod. That is what her coach told me when I called her back. She sneaked out to goof around with her new friends at the pool, hit her head, and made the others promise not to tell. Went back to her room, her single room, and missed this morning's early bird practice.
So we need to be concerned about stroke, vasospasm, hydrocephalus.
What are you saying?
Asks John. And then to me,
Is she speaking English?
Hush, I say again, louder. Listen. The doctor slows down.
Mr. Beiler, your daughter hit her head, and there was a brain bleed, blood in a layer of the covering of the brain. This happens to a lot, maybe a quarter, of people with a big head injury like Corey's.
No,
says John.
No.
Dr. Bach presses on.
We could see it on a scan we gave her, and we are going to need to operate right away.
Brain surgery?
Says John.
Absolutely not. We need a second opinion.
The doctor is taken aback.
That's your right, but I would recommend we proceed quickly. We are very sure of what is going on, and there are some time constraints. First, we need to make sure to take care of her vital functions, which we have done, and she is stable. Now we need to operate on her head to stop the bleeding.
Is this absolutely necessary?
Asks John.
Yes,
says the doctor, without missing a beat.
It is. Now. This is a complicated surgery, and I have performed it several times. The prognosis is much better than it used to be, but it is not perfect. I have an excellent track record, and I work with one of the best possible teams, and your daughter could not be in better hands. I just need your consent, and then I need to ask you some things about your daughter to prepare.
Go ahead, I say.
No,
says John.
Don't go ahead. I don't know what this means.
He is crying, I realize. He has lost his shit. He seems to be shrinking beside me. I grab his hand. Take some deep breaths, John. Sit down. I can take it from here. John looks at me, then at the doctor, then back to me.
You can handle this?
He whispers to me. I nod. Yes, I can, and I will. You just try to relax. Take deep breaths. Do you need to be sick?
No,
whimpers John. But he is holding my hand with a death grip.
Okay, then. Hang in there and let me do this. I think we need to work quickly.
Yes, your wife is correct, says the doctor. I will answer any questions you have as best I can, but the truth is we cannot delay this surgery.
We don't have any questions right now. I lie, because of course all this time my mind is spasming with panic and questions and blinding, incapacitating fear that cannot be allowed to take over. Tell me what you need to know, and then after that, have someone bring me a bunch of pamphlets or whatever, or send in an intern who can explain it to us slowly. The point is, let's get moving.
Good. Now, does Corey smoke?
No.
Use cocaine, to the best of your knowledge?
No.
Any chance she could be pregnant?
No.
Does she take oral contraceptives?
Yes.
What?
Cries John. Ignore him, I say to the doctor.
History of high blood pressure?
Paternal, I say.
Any previous concussion or traumatic brain injury?
No.
That's fortunate. She must be a strong diver.
Very.
Good. Let's get her back on that board. Someone will be coming in with paperwork and some long, detailed medical histories for you to fill out. You'll need to be very, very patient. This procedure takes as long as it takes, but usually at least 8 hours. The CNA will provide you some information on family self-care, as well as directions to the cafeteria.
Thank you, I say.
And the chapel, she adds, is on the 5th floor. And I know from that, more than from any of the medical talk, that things are as serious as I feared.
Okay, I say, nodding my understanding. You fix her, okay? I tell her. I hope I sound threatening, not desperate.
That's my job, and I'm very good at it. Your job is to hang in there while I work. Is anyone else coming? Maybe someone to look after your husband?
She tilts her head at him, and for the first time, I notice he has let go of my hand and is retching into a wastebasket.
He's not my husband, I tell her, though I'm not sure why that's important at the moment. But I will try to find him a minder.
The doctor nods. Your daughter is in very good hands, she tells me again, and I think oddly on the fact that among a doctor's many jobs is the task of getting the family to leave you alone so you can work.
I'm glad I'm not her. And yet, I wish I could go with her to be with Corey.
Can I come? I ask. Why don't you come give her a nice kiss before she goes into the OR, says Dr. Bach. Everyone knows the best medicine is a kiss from your mom.
I press my lips together tight to keep from crying. I'm thinking, really? Even at 15? Even for a TBI? The doctor puts her hand on my back gently and leads me to Corey's bed.
Okay,
says Dr. Bach to the staff when we walk into the room, now crowded with scrubs. This is Mom. She's going to hold Corey's hand and help her get off to sleep. Is anesthesia here?
Present, says a tall, thin man, and he introduces himself. I'll put this mask over Corey's mouth and nose, and the anesthesia will be delivered continuously using a carefully calibrated machine. She'll be fully unconscious and comfortable until the surgery is finished, he tells me.
Be careful, I tell him. She's a good one.
He nods.
I can tell.
Then, as if he's in a play, he tells the room we're ready to move.
Give her a hug and a kiss if you'd like,
he says to me, and I hug her and kiss her. And though her eyes are half closed, I tell her she looks great, and I can't wait to see her later today. And then I tell her I love her. And then I start telling her all the things I love about her. Her strength, her bravery, her spirit. And then the anesthesiologist interrupts me and gently says,
okay, Mom, time to go.
And Corey is wheeled away. And I am grateful. When she is gone, to find her room empty, to watch the doctors and nurses and cast of thousands trail away to the OR. Because though I would rather Corey be anywhere else but in the OR with a neurosurgeon, since that is where she is, at least she will not be able to see me cry.
Chapter 19. Dear Corey, You've asked me, over the last couple of months, if I could take back Dad. You asked me if I would change on my mom's Springer and never be the same. You wanted to know what would come after August ended. I didn't know the answer to any of those questions, so I didn't even try to answer them. Then you sneaked out of the dorms with the cool girls and hit your head on the diving board, and you were too embarrassed to go to the coach, so you went to bed alone, and now you might never wake up. And I have to tell you, it feels like that is all there is in the whole world, and all your questions and all the questions in the universe are easily answerable, except for the only ones that matter right now. What will happen to my beautiful, perfect daughter? Are you going to be okay? And I hate this. I hate that now that I know the answers to your questions, there's no way to tell them to you, except in my heart. So I'm going to tell them in my heart, and I'm going to pray and pray you hear them somehow. So, will I take back Dad? Honestly, I don't think it would make any of us happy, and I won't do it just to make him stay in your lives. If that's the only way to get him to stay, none of us really want to be with him, do we? We can do much, much better than that. But if you want me to be with Dad because you believe it's what this family needs, he and I will try to hear you out because you are the smartest, bravest, most clear-hearted girl I have ever known, and I will trust you to the end. Have I changed on my mom's Springer? Yes, but not in the way you think. I didn't revert to my party girl days with Talia. I didn't ever, not once, regret having you and Joe. I didn't get sold on the fancy clothes or the high-heeled shoes or even the fashion closet purses, though I am never going back to ill-fitting bras, and I vow on my mother's grave to spend whatever it costs to get you good support when or if your breasts ever need it. I liked dressing up from time to time, and I liked having time to myself. And I liked going out on dates. So the change you'll see when we all get home is that I show you how creating an enjoyable life, not just a vacation, but a life, is just another important part of being a mother, like serving vegetables once a week or lecturing your kids about slouching. When you get better, and you're going to get better, baby, you're going to date a lot and go to college and meet someone wonderful and have a kid. Maybe even in that order. And you're going to remember me and never, ever sell yourself down the river to be some kind of perfect mom. Not for a second. When you feel the urge, you're going to put on the well-fitting bra I bought you 15 years earlier and leave your kids in the care of a moderately competent person and go do something that is only for yourself. And if you don't know what that should be, then you're going to think about it until you do. And your last question, what will come when the summer ends? You'll come home. It's the only answer in the world that matters. You'll come home, and together, we'll figure everything else out. The first 3 hours that Corey is in surgery, the time goes very, very quickly. That is because I am crying, and looking up medical terms and crying, and looking up brain disorders and crying, alternately, and this is very time-consuming. It is not until almost noon that my phone battery gets low enough and I get dehydrated enough to peek my head out of Corey's empty hospital room. And when I get to the respite room, I find John asleep, sitting maybe 3 feet away from a TV blaring cable news directly into his face. I look at his sleeping form. He looks all tuckered out, like a child who played outside from sunup to sundown. I know if he is sleeping during our daughter's brain surgery, he is very tired. The kids, of course, have worn him out, just like they wore me out before I left. But also, John powers down when he's overwhelmed. He did it during my first labor and during shakeups at work and after the third baby was lost. It has always seemed to work for him. He'd come back rejuvenated and ready to move on. But for me, it was just one more way I felt lonely. I look at his sleeping form and find myself stunned that I ever shed tears over this man. 3 years ago, without realizing it,
I escaped a life sentence with a partner who literally slept through the hardest moments in our lives, leaving me alone to deal with them. The worst thing that ever happened to me also happened to be the luckiest moment of my life. If Corey is okay, please, please, she has to be okay. I will never waste another sad thought on my marriage again. I will celebrate what we had, our wonderful kids, our happier times. I will help John be the best father he can possibly be, wherever he chooses to live. But I will also date, live my life for real this time, and stop pining for something that wasn't that great in the first place. There's no Daniel in Pennsylvania, that's for sure and certain. But maybe I'll meet someone pleasant enough. Or maybe I'll travel to New York every once in a while to see him. Maybe we'll find some way to keep close. If Corey lives, I promise to the great beyond, I'll live too. And if she doesn't, well, then whatever I do won't matter much either way. After the first 6 hours of surgery, I start staring obsessively at the entry to the respite lounge. Every single time I hear steps or see a shadow moving outside the room, I pop up in my chair. After an hour of this, I decide to take a walk. It's going to be another hour or maybe two, and this vigil will only make me crazy. I walk out to the nurse's station to let someone know I'm on the move. But when I say I'm setting off for a walk, the nurse on duty tells me that my sister is on her way in. Or the patient's aunt, maybe? She clarifies when I look confused. Lena. Oh, thank God. Oh, that's great. I didn't realize she was coming, I say, and head to the elevators to meet her. The timing is perfect. The doors are just opening, and there is my best friend. And her arms are around me, and at last, I don't feel quite so terribly alone. What are you doing here? I ask when she's let me go, hugged me again, and then handed me a half-drunk chocolate milkshake. Is this for me? It was supposed to be for you, but I've been so worried I might have had a few sips. It was a long drive, you know? I kept it in a cooler for a while, but then it started shouting at me. Let me out! Let me out! In spite of everything inside me, a laugh comes out. Lena, how did you get here? How did you know we were here? You don't know? She says curiously. John texted me. I look heavenward. He did something right, I say. See? Are you talking to God? She asks. That's your job, I tell her. I'm just doing whatever it takes not to crack up while we wait for the surgery. How much longer? She asks. An hour? Two, maybe? It takes forever. Her brain is bleeding. I start to tear up. Oh, Corey, says Lena. How did this happen? I'm about to tell her, but the elevator pings again and the doors open.
Talia?
I cry.
What is going on? Why are we at the hospital?
She exclaims. She too wraps me in an enormous hug. It's so out of character, I start crying again.
Here,
she says, and hands me a giant stuffed cheetah.
What on earth?
I ask through my tears.
Everything else in the hospital gift shop was so awful, she says. I figure we can at least skin this and make you a nice coat. Oh my God, Talia. I'm so glad you're here. When a nun calls you swearing like a sailor and telling you to get your ass upstate, you get your ass upstate, she says.
Former nun, corrects Lena.
Did you fly here from Miami? I ask Talia. No, I flew into New York yesterday, planning to surprise you and do a deep Florida detox for the weekend. Look at the sun damage to my hair.
She tilts her head and gestures to her still perfect natural curls.
But you weren't there, and your stuff was all in boxes, and I was like, what? And then Lena called me, and I was like, shit! And then I borrowed an ex-boyfriend's car and drove here, and may I remind you that I do not have a valid driver's license? So I have had a very harrowing day.
I am shaking my head and crying.
Me too,
I tell her.
So I've heard. What happened?
An
And before I can even answer her, the elevator doors ping again, and this time all three of us face the doors expectantly. A hapless and confused orderly gets off the elevator while we stare. When she's out of the lobby, I say, "Corey hit her head on the diving board at camp. She didn't tell the coach because she wasn't supposed to be in the pool, I guess. She went to sleep, and then she didn't wake up when they knocked for practice, and she'd given her cell to Joe. The counselor let herself in and found her in there and called 911. The coach called me and told me to come here." "This is awful," Talia says.
"Corey is so tough," says Lena. "You haven't seen her in ages, Talia, but she's like a cross between a bulldog and the Highlander. She is going to get through this."
"Please be right," I beg her. "She's so... I can't..." Lena and Talia hug me together. One of them shushes me. The other says, "You won't have to." The elevator doors ping again. This time I just keep crying, holding on to my friends for dear life. The doors open. Daniel walks out.
"What?"
I say. Talia and Lena break away from me.
"Is that...
Daniel?"
I say. "Is it okay that I'm here?"
he asks. By way of answer, I run to him. "My daughter is hurt," I say. I want him to know exactly what I know. I want to shove it into his brain. "She has bleeding on her brain. She's in surgery. Her dad is asleep."
"Ah, Amy,"
he says. He holds me for a moment, then pulls back and looks into my eyes.
"Are you doing okay?"
he asks me.
"Definitely not,"
I tell him.
"But it's better with you all here."
Lena and Talia are looking at us curiously.
"Did you call him?"
I ask them both.
"I don't even know who he is,"
says Talia.
"He's the hot librarian,"
says Lena, and Daniel colors.
"He's the one who's been sleeping in your bed for the last month."
"Aha," says Talia. "You left your sports watch. I'm so glad it's not yours, Amy."
I smile. "It's his. Daniel, meet Lena and Talia." He gives them a quick glance.
"Nice to meet you. Wish it was in better circumstances. When does she get out of surgery?"
I look at my phone. "Soon. Or in hours. It all depends on what they find. But we should go back to the room just in case."
"Someone has to wait here," says Daniel. "Matt will be here any minute. He's the one who told me."
"Matt," I say. "Talia's Matt?"
"What about Matt?"
asks Talia.
"He's coming here," I say.
"We drove together," says Daniel. "He's parking the car."
Talia shakes her head in wonder.
"Okay, you two go inside and wait for the doctor," she commands. "Lena, you and I are going to meet up with Matt."
I go to the new CNA behind the reception desk and tell her Corey's family is here. "Two aunts, one uncle, and a cousin," I say, because Matt is too young to be anything else. She raises her eyebrows at us. Talia is black, Lena white, and Daniel Asian.
"I'll sign them in,"
she says, though she is obviously skeptical. She takes Daniel's ID and beeps us back to the ICU. The moment the doors are shut behind us, Daniel takes my hand.
"Is this okay?"
he asks.
"It doesn't have to be an us thing. I just... Matt called and said your daughter was seriously hurt, and I couldn't not come here. Just because, no matter what, I really have come to care, you know?"
"It's good you came. But how did Matt find you?"
"Twitter,"
says Daniel.
When your mom's Springer photos first went up, back in June, I direct messaged the magazine's account, saying we'd gone on one date and I was hoping they'd pass along my phone number."
"You did?"
I say in surprise. Daniel shrugs.
"It sounds kind of desperate, but when I saw the trending hashtag and realized it was you, I was too tempted to let it lie."
"Matt didn't tell me that," I say.
Yes, and I had some words for him about that today, he says. But it all worked out once I found you on Facebook.
He falters.
I mean, worked out as far as it worked out. That's not why I came. I'm not going to pressure you or anything. I'm just here as a friend.
I nod. I'm glad you're here. Friend or otherwise, I say. It's just my pre-existing condition is here too. I tilt my head into the doorway of the respite room where we now stand. Daniel doesn't flinch.
Good. Corey needs her family.
He's asleep at the moment, I say. I think his brain overloaded and then powered down. Daniel laughs.
Okay. Well, I'm done avoiding pre-existing conditions anyway. In fact, I have a new policy that if you don't have a pre-existing condition by the time you're our age, you haven't been doing something right.
Maybe, but I'm basically uninsurable at this point, I tell him, and I'm too worried about my daughter to care. He nods and squeezes my hand tightly.
I'm here for you. How about I'm in charge of feeding you, watering you, and holding your hand if you're scared?
I'm very scared, I tell him.
Then it's probably best that you don't let go.
I look down at his hand, up into his eyes. Yes, says my heart. It's Talia and Lena and Daniel and even Matt that I want here with me now. I want Joe to be here when we know everything is going to be all right, and Corey to laugh at my soggy tears when she finally wakes up, and John to be a wonderful father and nothing else, and Lena to be arm's reach away, and Talia to be showing up with stuffed cheetahs, and Daniel to be holding tight to my hand. Wherever these people are, New York, Pennsylvania, or a hospital upstate, that is where I also need to be. I put my head on Daniel's shoulder. Thank you, I say to him. And then there is a shadow in the doorway of the respite room, and the shadow turns into footsteps. And then, at last, finally, the footsteps turn into blue scrubs, and the unreadable face of Dr. Bach stands before me. And she inhales and starts to speak. Chapter 20. A week and a half later.
Amy, are you ready?
Daniel is holding my hand again, firmly. I shake my head. It's too soon, I tell him. I can't do this yet. His mouth forms a line.
It's time. Everyone is going to start to wonder.
I inhale. Okay, he's right. It's time. I can do this. Is she doped up? I ask carefully.
Nope, he says. The opiates wore off hours ago. She hasn't asked for a new dose. I think she's really on the mend.
I whisper a silent prayer of thanks for this the thousandth time. Let's go tell them then, I say, and drop his hand like it's on fire. We separately cross over the threshold into Corey's recovery room, where she is sitting in her bed next to Joe, watching an Animal Planet dog show in Spanish. Joe is shaking his head.
I still think I should have come home sooner, he says to me before I can even speak.
Why? Why would you miss out on space camp when it turned out she was going to be okay and couldn't do anything but rest anyway?
I don't know. I feel guilty is all. That I wasn't with her when she needed me most.
Corey punches her brother in the upper arm.
I didn't need you. I needed a neurosurgeon. Unless you actually got your medical license in Alabama instead of your nerd certification.
Joe frowns. The support of your dearest sibling is sort of being taken for granted here.
Nah, she tells him. It's just that you got here at the exact right time. Mom was starting to drive me nuts, and Dad's in Chicago, so it's all on you from here on out.
Daniel looks at me, one eyebrow aloft.
He's gone again. Already?
I shrug. He just went out to take some meetings, I say, not mentioning that I suspect having Daniel around was weirding him out enough to make that sound like an extra good idea this week. He'll be meeting us back in Pennsylvania for the rest of the summer. And the kids will see him again at Thanksgiving and winter break.
I've talked to the kids about this endlessly now that Corey is in the clear, and John has too. Yes, yes, the kids keep telling us. They are okay with this plan. Yes, they want to spend Christmas vacation overseas. No, they never expected he'd stay. Yes, they had fun, but they want to go back to their real lives soon, and they'll see him again every couple of months anyway, and all of next summer. Plus, Corey helpfully points out, per the quickie marital settlement agreement that a judge will be hearing just before school starts, he'll be paying me back child support, which makes this entire summer worth it. Daniel knows John and I filed for divorce, but he hasn't been privy to any of the family conversations, as he's been trying to be a friend of mine and give my family lots of space. He looks consternated, so I add, this is just the reality of John. Joe nods. He's not perfect, but he's our dad, so no criticizing.
Okay,
says Daniel.
Well, your mother and I came in to tell you two that
we know, says Corey. You're dating. Everyone knows. I think one of the Kardashians just tweeted about it. Please don't say it out loud, okay? It's gross to think about your mom having sex. Unless, do you need us to give you the facts about safe intercourse?
You,
cries Joe. He sneers at Daniel viciously, or as viciously as Joe has ever sneered. Apparently no one is good enough for his mom. I could have brought home the Pope and Joe would have found fault.
No thanks, I say. We can talk to our doctors if we have questions.
But what about your, feelings about us being a couple? Corey shrugs.
Do we have to move to New York? She asks.
I shake my head. All three of us are going to be going there from time to time, I warn. And one weekend a month, you'll be staying over with Auntie Lena.
Can I have Diet Coke when I'm there?
Asks Corey. I ignore her. But the point is, no one is moving. We have our lives here, and Daniel and Cassie have their lives there. We'll figure things out our own way and reevaluate when Cassie graduates next spring.
At the moment, she's planning on applying to Temple and Princeton, Daniel says. So she may make our lives that much easier by moving nearby.
Whoa, says Corey. Princeton?
Her eyes are wide. It's not a competition, I say.
Well, not a fair one, she says. It's not my fault I'm too brain damaged to go to Princeton.
I laugh. You cannot apply that excuse retroactively. Anyway, there's nothing wrong with you, and I know because I have made them order every test they have in this hospital. Joe raises his hand.
Joe, you don't have to wait to be called on, I tell him.
He's a teacher, says Joe, giving Daniel the side eye.
I'm a teacher, I say in wonderment, mostly to myself.
Okay, Joe, says Daniel. Go ahead.
Can I apply to Bronx Science?
He asks.
I look at Daniel. He looks at me. He is grinning. I shake my head.
Let's just slow things down a bit here, people. We're dating, that's all. Stop moving in with my new boyfriend.
What?
Joe says.
Corey will be graduated and working at the beauty parlor by then.
Corey gives him a mild shove at this.
Country Day doesn't even have a second year of physics. Plus, their chess team kills ours every year.
I dismiss him and say, we'll see. But I can't help but imagine it. Moving to NYC in 2 years? Joe kicking butt at an academic magnet school, truly challenged and growing into the best he can be? Me teaching in a school library that could really use me? Building out flexologies for truly underserved students? Daniel and I living together in the same amazing city? Reading together every night. I have to admit, it sounds pretty nice.
I'm not going to work in a beauty parlor, sneers Corey. I'm going to dive for Penn State.
I hold my hand up firmly.
When I am fully recovered and the doctor says it's okay, she adds.
And your mother masters transcendental meditation, I say. She cuts an exasperated glance at Joe.
Don't worry about Mom, says Joe. She's going to be too busy to notice.
what with her new boyfriend, he uses air quotes, and the big NEA grant he got for her.
Corey inclines her head. What's this? An NRA grant?
NEA, National Endowment for the Arts, says Daniel. Your mom's Chicago friend, Catherine, helped me put together a grant proposal a while back, right after the library conference. Ever since, she and I heard your mom talk about the flexology. We just knew it had legs, whether your mom believed it or not. Finding a way to get it off the ground was a Hail Mary to get you to keep going out with me, he adds to me with a wink.
I shake my head in wonderment. I still can't believe you two managed that on the sly.
Wait, is this for that ebook reading choice thing you started at Country Day? Asks Corey. That was actually kind of fun, as far as reading goes.
Yes, exactly, I tell her. We couldn't think of a way to get it funded on a larger level. School boards are such slow-moving machines, and we were trying to get free rights to some really valuable novels to make the financials work and have it represent a diverse population. But then it hit us. Well, it hit Daniel. Rather than try to get the rights from the authors for free, we could get someone else to pay the authors, like an agency whose very purpose is to support artists on the community level. So I put it to Catherine, and she knew a grant writer on the PTO, and one thing led to another, Daniel says. And now your mom has a lump sum to run a pilot program in underfunded schools.
So you're dating this guy because he got your big Dorkfest librarian thing funded? Asks Corey, incredulous.
I laugh.
Nah, I'm dating this guy for the Latin jokes.
Daniel perks up. Why did Marcus Aurelius make his kids eat grits? He asks the room. Because he wouldn't accept ad hominem arguments.
We all cringe. Mostly because he's very attractive, I amend. Joe looks at Corey in horror. She makes a dramatic retching sound.
Corey, I say, I've missed your nuanced commentary. If I haven't said it enough, thank you for doing such a good job at staying alive this week.
Yes, adds Daniel. I especially appreciate it because otherwise I wouldn't have gotten to meet you. And I'm pretty sure your mom wouldn't have called me ever again, grant or no grant.
Corey says, that's kind of a selfish perspective on the value of a young woman's life.
You and Cassandra are going to get along very well, he says.
I smile and nod, though I am not so sure. The beauty is, they don't have to. Daniel has given me a way to be where I need to be, to celebrate all the things I discovered in myself in New York, and still fulfill all my responsibilities in Pennsylvania. For me, life after John doesn't have to mean martyrdom and loneliness, or some Brady Bunch-style mishmash of two already happy established families. There is a third way.
I get this now. I get now that you can love what you have, love your kids and your life and your friends, and still want more.
I get that it's okay to go out and get more. More love, more friendship, more fulfillment, and still be a wonderful mom. Because of Daniel, because of my friends, because of Corey and Joe, I finally understand that traditional math does not apply to mothers. I can be 100% a mother and, though it isn't easy, still be 100% myself as well. It means changing how I think. It means understanding that to care for my children well, I must never again forget to care for myself. And for me to learn all that once and for all, it took more than a village. For me, it took a hashtag momspringa.
Hey, you. These are going to slay you, I think. They've been coming in all month since the issue released, and some are addressed to us, but some are definitely meant for you. A few of my favorites are on top. And have you checked out our Twitter feed lately? Kiss, kiss. Talia. P.S. You'll be happy to know Matt got a promotion. Well, technically it's a promotion, and there's a big raise, too, though I'd sooner die than do that job. Online marketing trend strategist. Ick! Better him than me. But he's thrilled, and he's going to be crazy good at it. He made up a care package from the fashion closet for you as thanks for being the face of Momspringa. I tucked some things in for Corey, too. Enjoy! Don't forget to wax!
Dear Pure Beautiful Magazine, I never write into magazines, but I just want to write you and tell you how great your article, Do You Need a Hashtag Momspringa, was. I had no idea Momspringas even existed, but once I found out, you better believe the first person I told was my husband. I told him, if you don't give me a Momspringa in the next 2 weeks, I am leaving you. And honestly, I think I mean it. I have 3 beautiful children, and I have done nothing but wipe noses and change diapers for the last 7 years. And for fun, I make dinners that my 3-year-old would rather die than eat. And then I make a second dinner for him, and then my husband comes home from his weekly, yep, every week, happy hour with the guys, too tipsy to put the kids to bed. Plus he has his bowling nights, and he works late, and on Sundays he just sleeps and sleeps while I wrestle the kids to church so that my own mother won't disown me. And let me tell you, she has all kinds of ideas about how I should be parenting and keeps saying it's time for me to lay down the law. But where is she when the healthy meal is set out and no one has touched their green beans? I will tell you where. She's standing by the freezer handing out Dove bars. And my youngest doesn't even have all his teeth yet. And I am telling you, if I don't get a night by myself alone in a bed with no one else in it for at least 8 straight hours, I am going to run away forever. So, thanks for publishing that piece. Though it was kind of crazy that the lady in the story did exercise classes while she was away from her kids. I would never make that mistake. Yours, Becca Alt, Omaha, Nebraska. Dear Amy B., I asked the magazine that printed your story to pass my note along so you would know what an inspiration you've been to me and my friends. I found your article in my dentist's office, and as soon as I read it, I knew I had to talk to my girlfriends. We call ourselves the Monday Mamas because we were all in group therapy class 6 years ago when we all had postpartum depression at the same time. Things are a lot better now, thanks to lots of support and good meds, but parenting is still a ton of work, as you know. Anyway, there are 4 of us Monday Mamas, and we decided right then to help support each other so we would each get 1 week on a Momspringa. We are going in turns according to our work schedules, and while one of us is gone, the other 3 of us are going to carpool the kids to school and look after them with sleepovers and share the work as needed. We've each been putting $15 a month together into a spa fund since our kids were really little, but in all this time, we've never found a way for the 4 of us to get even 1 night off together to stay in a hotel and get a massage. Now, instead of that, we are divvying that money up 4 ways, and each of us will have enough to stay in a hotel and just have some quiet time to think and relax for an entire week. I know from your article you read a lot, but when my Momspringa comes, I am going to go to the movies every day, because I haven't been to a movie since my first daughter was born, and I don't even remember what movie theater popcorn smells like. I just remember a long time ago how much I used to love going to the movies. My friend Calla is going to spend her time in the swimming pool. She used to be a master's swimmer, but the only gym in town with childcare doesn't have a pool. Noelle has a little boy who just weaned, so she says she wants to sleep the whole week. But I bet once she catches up on sleep a little, she'll have enough energy at least to take a few nice long walks or read a good book. And my best friend Anne, well, she is taking her guitar. Amy, none of us have family nearby, and not all of us have very sympathetic partners right now. And until your article came out, it just never occurred to us that it would somehow be possible to take a few days to ourselves, much less that it would be okay. But after we read your story, we knew it wasn't just okay for moms to take breaks. It was required. So, thank you so much for being brave and giving us the push we needed. Sincerely, the Monday Mamas, Baraboo, Wisconsin. Dear Pure Beautiful Magazine, I would like to write to register my disappointment, nay, my outrage, at your irresponsible hero worship of that pathetic excuse for a mother you featured in your article about mothers running away from their responsibilities. I realize that you have to sell magazines, and that means your pages will be full of sex and other abominations. But to discover a 7-page article about a woman who abandoned her own children to a man who was virtually a complete stranger, only to jump into the beds of every man in New York City and spend her every waking moment worried about her makeovers and health clubs, goes well past even the worst thing I could have prepared myself for. What if your article causes other women, normally good, responsible women, to do the same? Did you ever think of that before putting this dangerous article into print? The thought is nothing short of revolting. Shame. Shame on you, Pure Beautiful Magazine. Think of the children. Please cancel my subscription immediately. Sincerely, Deborah Stuckey, Phoenix, Arizona. Search. Top tweets featuring hashtag MyMomSpringa. @EatPraySway. I'd take hashtag MyMomSpringa in New York just like that lady, but I would wear way better clothes. @PureBeautyMag. @TheMommyMess. Hashtag MyMomSpringa. Just one big bed, a dark, cool room, occasional room service, wine. @LawyerRenee. I would kill for hashtag MyMomSpringa. I'd go stay with my childless friend at her lake house in the middle of nowhere. See how the other half lives. Maybe learn to sail. Nah, I'd just nap. @MomOfMatt. Even just thinking about hashtag MyMomSpringa makes me happy. 2 weeks till the beach, baby. Thanks @PureBeautyMag for starting the convo. @NoahTheFarmer. Can I have a hashtag DadSpringa? My baby isn't born yet, but my wife is working constantly on her new cookbook, and I need to escape kitchen duty. Hashtag MyMomSpringa. @NianKnowsNothing replied, no. @GeorgiePorgy3. Hashtag MyMomSpringa would be in Venice. No, screw Venice. Tuscany. With that guy from the movie. And Matt Damon. Hashtag backup plan. @Catherine in Chicago. Hashtag MyMomSpringa is literally anywhere my children are not. Hashtag real talk. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of The Overdue Life of Amy Byler by Kelly Harms. Performed by Amy McFadden. Engineered by Larry McKay. Performance copyright 2019 by Brilliance Publishing, Inc. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.